Hi, this is Andrew.
And this is Amy, and this week AADL talks to local author Karen Simpson.
Sherlania talks to Karen about her first novel, Act of Grace, the process of writing a book over 10 years, and the insights readers can offer writers about their own books.
So Karen, will you tell us a little bit about Act of Grace?
Well, Act of Grace is a novel about an African-American girl who takes a bullet to save the life of a Klansman named Jonathan Gilmore, and everybody wants to know why, especially in her hometown, because of rumor has it that the Gilmore family was responsible for the deaths of not only her father, but several other people in the town. And the answer that she gives is not the answer anybody expects. So that's basically the gist of it.
All right. So tell us about how you came up with that idea. That's such a huge topic that you've...
I guess the original start of the idea happened in 1996. I think it was in June. And it was during the Klan rally. And the Klan rally ended up in kind of like a minor riot. But during the fight that broke out, a young black woman named Keisha Thomas, who was only 18 at the time, saw that a man had been basically attacked by other supposedly nonviolent protesters, and they were kicking him. And in the spur of the moment, she ran over, threw her body over the top of him, and prevented him from being hurt further until the police could get there to save him. And everybody kind of talked about that. You know, like most writers, you're kind of like in the background and you're listening to people talk back and forth, about why did she do it? Was she crazy? Was she kind of a saint? But she didn't give an answer for quite some time, or at least I didn't read about her answer. But when I read her answer, it was just really profound because she said that he was somebody's son, and that you can't beat anybody up just because he doesn't believe in what you believe him. And I thought that that was such a profound answer for somebody who's 18 years old, because most grown folks can't even like get their head around that issue. So that was the beginning of the idea. And then I kept thinking about it and thinking about it, but I wasn't writing regularly. But then I started my degree in historic preservation, and I was doing some research on the Detroit riots in 1863, which not too many people know that there was a riot in 1863, but it was a pretty major one. And I was reading the transcripts of the victims, of the black victims of the riot, money back for basically what happened, because basically what happened, everything was burned to the ground, except for the church and a couple other buildings. I read that, I went to sleep, and in the middle of the night I had this dream, and I heard a voice shouting the first line of the novel, which is, "Mr. Gilmore was supposed to die that day, but I got in the way." And now everybody's wondering if I'm... Well, I won't say what she actually says. but that's kind of where it started. And I woke up, started the novel, and then for about 10 years, I heard Grace basically narrating the rest of this novel. And you pick up, you know, things along the way, different ideas. People have asked me, was this novel something that was mine? I do believe it's mine, but sometimes novels are given to you, and sometimes novels come from other sources, but I think this novel was given to me to write, so.
When you write a novel about the topics that you've taken on in your novel, you know, was there fear involved with that, or did you feel that people might you know, once your novel was released, look at you differently or begin to question your position on things that don't necessarily, you know, you wrote a fictional work. Do you feel?
I'm going to be honest. I think everything more or less in the book is me. It's basically my position on a lot of things, issues about race, about tolerance, about grieving. If people are looking at me differently, then they probably didn't know me that well. I mean, it's kind of, I'm pretty much an introvert anyways, and I'm the introvert of a very boisterous family who are much more out front than I am. So many people tend to know my brothers and sisters and my parents when they were alive much better than they know me. So, yeah, I think if you read the book, it's me.
I've watched your novel evolve over the years, and I know that there are swaths of the novel that didn't find a place in this particular work. So what do you do with that stuff? Do you think that any of that will resurface or will be reworked or anything like that?
Originally, this novel was an epistolary, I think that's what you call it, a series of letters. And I tend to like those novels for some reason, I think because they're very personal. And they kind of, they have like a historical kind of way of viewing things of people's lives because they can be very, very intimate. For a lot of different reasons, that did not work in this novel, so that had to be dropped. But the book that I'm working on now, the letter format does come back, and some of the ideas from that novel are being pushed into the second novel. Fortunately, there is not a lot that my editors made me get rid of. And everything that they suggested were changes that really were for the best. And dropping the novel, the letter format in Grace was really better, much better.
To me, Act of Grace seems almost like it should have come with a list of recipes and a soundtrack. The larger themes of the role of food and nourishment in our lives and the cultural significance of music permeate this work. How does this all fit together for you?
Well, I come from a family that we're very, very much into music, very much. My father majored in music in college, so we listened to everything from country and Western to... my mother was big on musicals because we used to tease her that we were the only black children that knew all the the lyrics to like musicals, and she didn't find that funny, but we were, and we listened, and we were encouraged to listen to everything. We were allowed to, you know, to choose what music that we like. So my brothers and sisters and I have very divergent musical tastes. My brother John really likes country, Western. Delphi really is into jazz. I'm kind of more all over. If you looked at my collection, it's a little bit of everything. My mother was a great cook. She majored in home economics in college. And so I learned to cook when I was young, and I collect recipe books. And for me, cooking is a way of keeping culture and people alive because it is a passing down of from generation to generation, different food ways. So it's only natural that a lot of that kind of filters into the work. So.
Who are your biggest musical and culinary influences? Would you say that those are your parents, or would you say?
My father gave me a CD on African music from South America. And I remember getting it that Christmas and playing it over and over and over again. It is still one of my favorite. It's my writing music. So that's the music I put on when I'm writing. So I think my father very much influenced my taste in music. He would buy me the things that I don't think people, certainly not my mom would have bought me, but my father would buy me things that he knew I was kind of interested in. My mother, definitely, and Edna Lewis, who who kind of wrote this kind of seminal works on Southern Black cooking. So, yeah.
It can be argued that Grace has or is on the verge of an eating disorder. What would you say if someone said that?
I get asked that a lot.
Do you?
Yes. What I was actually trying to get across is that Grace's ability to embody the spirits requires an enormous amount of energy. And so in some sense, she's eating because of all the abuse in her life. But at the same times, when she has to channel the ancestors, that's an enormous amount of energy. So she is consuming a lot of energy. And there were several people in one of the first book clubs that I did that noticed, you know, what I intended for them to notice, that she doesn't really gain weight during, you know, she's still the same. And that by the end of the book, she's really not eating that much, not her per se. And then you see that the talk about food kind of drops out, you know, but that's at the point where she's kind of accepted her role, that this is what she has to do.
You were raised and went to school in Michigan, and your novel is set in Michigan. How important is place in your work?
Very important. Michigan has a really important part of my life because it's one of the terminal places during the Great Migration where a lot of people moved up here. So it has a lot of history. And I also wanted to place the novel about racial strife in the North because I think that gets underplayed. I think, in fact, a lot of people, when I first started writing the novel, even though it says Michigan up front, automatically just assumed that I miswrote it, that I really meant for it to be down south. I can understand why they thought that. I can really do, because it's just easier to not think of the North as having racial issues and to think that all of that was just down south. And the town, which is actually a town, but I'm not going to say what town for a variety of reasons, it did have issues of racial violence. So when I was considering place, I was really coming from trying to grapple with that issue of racial violence in other places, in places that people don't think about or don't want to think about.
Your novel deals with Oba, an African trickster figure in the Br'er Rabbit stories that come from the African American South. You use these myths and stories to tell your own contemporary tale. As an author, is there something in particular that you're trying to communicate through this setup?
That there is a continuum that we don't tend to think about, that these stories still have relevance, they still have meaning, and they are still very much alive in African American culture and African American lives. So Br'er Rabbit is still an important story about how do you disassemble and still get what you want, which is still very much a part of being African American, of just, you know, learning to be slippery, but still at the same time, still getting done what needs to be done. And the Br'er Rabbit story is connected to the Hare and the Moon story, which is very much about eternity, about the life after death, or the circle of kind of life, birth, life, death, and then the recycling of souls.
So are there parts of being a published author that have surprised you or overwhelmed you, or insert any other word there?
What has overwhelmed me, I think, is the amount of basically marketing work that authors have to do nowadays. It is nothing like the old days where basically your publisher could do all that for you or would do that all for you. But no, it's basically, even if you're, you know, published by a traditional publisher, it's still very much up to you. For me, you know, I'm still working a full-time job and I still have, you know, other interests. So it is really hard to set aside time to write the next novel, to do all the stuff that has to be done to make sure that the book gets out into the marketplace. I knew that was going to be part of it. I just didn't know how much it was going to be. But you know, when you get your dream, I'm not going to complain. I'm just not going to complain about it. It's just I have wanted to be a writer since I was 5 years old, and much of what has happened is looks very much like the dream, so I can't complain.
Earlier you mentioned that you had gone to some schools. I mean, knowing what I know about your process, knowing how hard you worked over the last 10 years, which is something people don't necessarily associate with the writing life. They think like, oh yes, these people, they just write and they drink and they write and they look fabulous with their scarves and their earrings and they write. And you've spent a lot of time. You belong to several writing groups. You've gone through several drafts. Is that something that you talk about when you're talking to young people, or do you talk to them about reaching their dream? I mean, there's so many things you could say to young people. What do you do?
Many of the, I talked to my niece's group, and they're eighth and they were seventh and eighth graders. What I found funny is that they were very much about the money. You know, I was kind of like laughing, and I'm going like, okay, you know, how do I talk to them about like not crushing their dreams? You know, because they hear it, but what they hear on TV is they knew about J.K. Rowling, because they asked me about that, and she has a lot of money. But, you know, I told them, I said, not every writer is like that. I said that writers tend to have, you know, second jobs, or they have to do other things. That's kind of how I framed it. And I said, you know, there are police officers who write mystery novels. And so it's kind of like, I said, it's kind of like a second career. And one guy, he kind of like got it and said, so it's like a side job. And I go, yeah, it's like a side job. And I think, and the teacher said afterwards, hey, you know, that I handled it pretty well, because I was really concerned about not making it seem like this is something that they couldn't do, but at the same time being practical about it. They're going to have to particularly live in a practical world where they're going to have to do several things in order to make a living.
I hear you've been going to some book groups as well. How has that been?
The first book group was like being in the room with 10 or 9 of Nana Grace's. They were older Black women from the community. They were great.
Now, when we're talking older, I just really need to know how old you're talking, because the generations seem to have very distinct characteristics. So
70s, some of them 70s, okay. You know, 60s. 70s, all I right. think. Some of them had known my parents, which is kind of that. So they knew my book inside and out, up and down. They were quoting stuff back to me. I was really, really impressed. And they grilled me. They grilled me about every character. They grilled me. And I, you know, it is every writer's dream to be in that, you know, where people know your characters as well as you do. And then it gave me like some insights about other characters that I hadn't really thought about. And that it was great. They were a great group. I, you know, I wrote them a nice thank you note, but I told them I was grateful from the bottom of my heart for that, because it was like my mother was there. But I've only done one other group. I think they had some, and I suspect this is going to be part of the discussion at other groups, about the whole issue of racial cleansing of towns, which is the other issue in Grace that I don't think that people are quite aware of, that whole towns could be cleansed of Black people and remained cleansed of them for years afterwards, and the whole story just basically buried. You know, I was telling them about May 30th of this year will be the 50th anniversary of the Tulsa race riots in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and how basically that town was, the Black town was basically destroyed. And in some cases, like the imagined case in my book, Black people go back and basically repopulate the area. It's those things that are not talked about that can make for towns that, you know, are racially divided, even though, you know, populations, mean Black and white people may live in the town and it's not discussed. That was hard to get to wrap their mind around, that could happen.
Karen, what's next for you?
I think for me, it's getting the next novel done. I think I have a a loose deadline of March to get it done. And I don't know if we're going to make it, but that's basically the next thing there.
Well, that's a significantly different trajectory of birthing a novel than a 10-year.
Yeah, that's, I think, what most authors face is that first novel, you get a significant amount of time because it's your first novel, and you know, but the second novel, when you sign the contract, it's due, and then you have to make that deadline. It's not so hard. I made sure that, you know, one of my mentors had told me to make sure that I got as far into the second novel before the first novel was actually out. It's just much, much easier to, I was halfway through, so it's easier to, you know, to work on it and still sell the first novel.
If you'd like to learn more about Karen Simpson and Act of Grace, visit her website at karensimpsonwrites.com. Music for this episode was Familiar Tune by Nathan Mathis, which you can find on the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnatune.
AADL Talks to Karen Simpson has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.